Hey there, welcome to this week's episode of the Inside Running Podcast. We hope you are doing well. This week's sponsor, the Inside Running Podcast, is proudly Koro's Wearables. They make GPS watches and maybe the newest GPS watch brand on the market, but they've already partnered with some of the best road, trail, and mountain athletes in the world. I think I saw the other day, Brett Robinson, Lisa Waitman, Sam McEntee, Luke Matthews. I think even Stewie is repping one of these watches at the moment, so they must be pretty good. Do yourself a favor and check out the brand that Runner's World named the Gear of the Year in 2019. Welcome to episode number 125 of the Inside Run Podcast. Thank you for joining us for another week, ladies and gents. It's good to have a bit of normality back here, talking to my couple of co-hosts, Julian Spence and Bradley Croker. Welcome to you up in Canberra, Bradley, the 78th fastest marathon runner Australia has ever produced. How are you going?
I'm not too bad. Am I still that ranking?
Still 78th, refreshed it today, had a bit of a look, found a new website, and yep, you're 78th, just in front of John Birmingham in 1973 and Gary Hand in 1983. That's who you're situated near on the rankings. Did you know that?
I think Gary Hand, I think he was from Canberra. Well, there's definitely some association with Canberra, but no, I didn't know that that's who I was around.
That's who you stack up with right down there. Yep, I did some research today. Now that I'm unemployed, I got time to dig into these kind of stats. And Julian Spence down in Ballarat, the 42nd fastest marathon runner Australia has ever produced. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, mate. Who am I around?
Yeah, tell me. We'll get these. Sean Forrest and Andrew Lloyd are the two people.
Oh, get the fuck out.
Exactly. Two absolute big dogs of Australian distance running, and you're just right there with them.
I'm feeling good now.
What about how you shared the Andrew Lloyd video today on our Facebook as well?
So good. How good are the videos?
Oh, that reminded me of my own kick this morning, actually, when I scrolled through that one this morning.
You know what reminded me of you? John Ngugi dying hard on the last lap.
Hey, when did you want me to send the stall video through to you, the Herb Hedeman mile that I won? I was thinking about that. Could maybe get a run one day on the Facebook page. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, last time we watched it, though, it had like all these skip lines, like right when you finished, like someone had rewind it and played it and rewound it and played it and rewound it and played it over and over again.
Yeah, we'll have to replace those.
You're going to need a better copy.
Yeah, that's the only one I've got.
Moose, he really rates his kick, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Not
many people have outkicked me in their life, Bradley, actually.
Yeah, I believe I'm one of them, and I was old.
Yeah, that was when my iron was low. I've got an excuse for that one. Anyone wondering as well, I was 112th on the all-time Australian marathon list. So just if you're playing at home, remember that number. Oh, actually, Skillsy was just behind me, actually. He was 7 seconds behind me. Who else? Ewan McRae, he was just in front of me, actually. That was another name. Scott McTaggart.
Three solid runners there.
Yeah, Scott McTaggart wasn't far in front of me either. Past interviewee, Bradley, your mate. So, yeah.
Irwin lives in Canberra as well.
I do.
Was so a goal of yours, obviously top 100 then, Brady.
Well, I did also look up 213 just to see where I could have been around, and that was about 50th. So, you know, rolling with some real big dogs down there, but I don't have those names in front of me right now. Thanks to Styx Brewery for sponsoring the podcast. Just opened a can of Inside Running Pale Ale. They've got a new beer coming out. It's a ginger pale ale. Haven't had it yet. It's on its way. Yeah. Can't wait for it to arrive, actually.
Positive splat.
Yeah, yeah. Another good running analogy. And, yeah, so thanks to those guys over at Styx for setting us up with some beers. Might be hard to get beers in the next couple of weeks. Julian Spence, you want to tell me about your running week? What's been happening?
Yeah, I'll tell you about it. It was quite strange. Probably the most obscure week I've ever had. Let me just pull it up. I've been off Strava a bit lately, which is been off everything, just been busy, you know. So last week ran 119 Ks, pretty front weighted actually, because shit just got crazy at the end of the week. So on the Monday, we ran 12.3 K. I actually did some I fucking don't know, I'm not clicking on it. I did 12 K, ran for an hour, and then in the afternoon ran with Brett Coleman down in Anglesey. We chatted about the coronavirus the whole way, of course.
Oh, fancy that.
Good loop, though, where we ran in Anglesey, like about as good as you could get. Tuesday in the morning, ran Currawong Falls loop, so down at Distillery Creek Picnic Ground starts, and you run single track for like 15K. It's one of the best trails I ever run, that one. Used to drive down from Anglesey when I lived there and run on it, and used to like go for bushwalks there when I was a kid. It was just a really cool waterfall, which doesn't really flow anymore, but it used to be pretty good. In the afternoon, went to the beach during that afternoon, just like chilled out on the beach, went for a few swims. There's something about the ocean that's so soothing and calming, and sort of like, at the time it's freezing, and then you kind of feel like rejuvenated after you go under the water, and it just made me feel pretty good. So I went out for a jog that afternoon, saw some mates, hang out with some mates down there, the Witten boys. They, funnily enough, they used to be tourists when I was a local there, and now they're locals and I'm the tourist. Just a reverse of roles. Wednesday, ran with in the morning, what did I do?
Did some hill reps here, didn't you?
Oh, hill reps, yeah, with Ali. So me and Ali. Ali's actually like, she'd probably tell you on the Road to Nowhere podcast, but she found out she was anemic again, which kind of explains why she's been feeling a bit rough lately, and some of her training hasn't been brilliant. So that's good news for her to find that out, because now she can get drugged up again. We ran a session five by... sets of five sets, 60-second hill rep, jog halfway down, 30-second hill rep, jog halfway down to the halfway of that 30-second rep, and go 15 seconds up. So you get harder and more explosive the shorter the rep, and then at the end of that 15-second rep, you jog all the way back down the bottom of the hill, start the sets again. So I did five of those. They're a good workout. I really like that. We say it all the time, but hill reps, it's great just to not have to worry about pace, just focus on effort. And in the afternoon, ran back in Ballarat with had a good chat with Mona about coaching philosophy, about the old school versus the new school. And because Freeman, my mate Matty Freeman, he's really getting into his running. He doesn't know what to do, doesn't know what sort of training to follow or whatever. So he's got Mona in one ear, me in the other. It would have been great to sort of record that conversation, I reckon.
Because did you convince Mona that things have changed?
Well, we both have the same principles, right? So the same principles are that you need to be consistent and you need to run high mileage to be a good marathoner. It's just when we sort of knuckled down into the number of workouts per week and the rest days required, and and how fast you run your easy runs. There's a few like, in the end, we were pretty like amicable during that chat. Sometimes we disagree on things, and we obviously do. But
so is Mona a fan of the fast easy run? Is he?
No, not really. But he used to do it. Yeah. So he would always sort of say, oh, we always used to jog so slow on Sundays because we did a really hard Saturday session. But you talk to the blokes who trained with him and they're like, oh, no, they used to fucking smash it on Sundays. So who knows, really? But it was good conversation. We needed more. I only went half an hour. I needed to go a full hour, I reckon. Thursday morning, just an easy 7K. Obviously, some didn't fit in there. I think I was. This is when shit started to get real with the sort of coronavirus and everything. And the next morning, I did some surges on this run and went to the gym. When I say went to the gym, I don't go to like an F45 or some shit where people are like jam packed. It was pretty open. There was about three people in there when we were there, like me, Bree, and the instructor or the strength and conditioning coach at the time. So it was sort of safe then. It was all legal at the time. And then Saturday, ran a Wolf's Loop tempo with Watto, went out. Mono was on his mountain bike. This is the really hard hilly tempo loop that we run, and I put on the new Fuel Cell TCs. It's kind of like a bit of a Vaporfly competitor, a bit more durable, a bit more stable training, maybe slightly more training focused, but good on the dirt. Ran with Watto. Like, I really wasn't feeling this, sort of pretty flat, and it was good to hurt ourselves again. He was a little bit behind me on the uphills. Well, I was just kind of cruising with him on the uphills. But what would happen is, because he can run downhill okay, he fucking drops me on the downhills. I thought, how rude. Imagine having a bloke run with you, wait for you on the uphills, and then try to put time into him on the downs. That's just
don't move.
That's rude, really. In the end, we ended up running that really fucking well for ourselves. Like, I think it was his fastest time ever on the loop, which is crazy because he runs that all the time. And he's only been running 100K a week. So it shows that fitness hangs around. And like with how easy I did it, I think it was my second fastest time ever. It really is. It shows you, and it kind of inspires me to keep training when you get a bit of a glimpse of sort of how fit you still are. So Wednesday, I woke up Sunday morning and I was going to do 2 hours, but raining the whole way. Had like wet clothes, ran with a half group, like there's three of us, I think. In the end, we got rolling, but at the start, it was pretty cruisy. But I was so wet, I got nipple chafe. Never had bloody nipple chafe in my life, but I started to get those crusty bits on the end a few days later. Yeah. You know?
Got to put band-aids on there.
Ah, Body Glide, mate, Body Glide.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, very so that's good. A week. 119K. I was pretty happy to get 119K based on the last 4 days, and Spark's back again, I think. Now Spark's back.
One of your titles there, hanging by a thread.
Oh yeah,
you're still hanging.
That was like hanging by a thread. Sort of refers to how easy it would be to just stop running entirely right now and focus on other things, like wake up, focus on work. Work, 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 work. That's it. So that's not like, that's just running at that point was so low priority that I was lucky to get out, and I'm glad I did. Every time, always come back, glad you went out, surely.
Yeah, for sure. Bradley Croker, what have you been doing?
I had my biggest week since probably October. I got through 143.5K, and I'm absolutely loving my running at the moment. It's just great to feel the way it used to feel. It's given me a sense of sort of purpose and focus when I guess a lot of, just feel like humanity at the moment is just sort of in limbo, not really knowing what's happening from day to day, but running just gives me that routine. And yeah, as Moose was saying there, like there's a lot of people that are going, oh, it's easy for me maybe to not run at the moment because there's no races. But I sort of compare this now to those days where it's pissing down rain, you go out and get a run done and you feel great about it because you know that maybe some other people aren't doing that at the moment. So, that's sort of the analogy that I sort of feel when I'm training at the moment.
It's
so,
the real chip on the shoulder kind of stage, don't you reckon?
Yeah, and I guess I've really struggled the last 12 to 18 months. And I said a few weeks back that, like I wouldn't care if I didn't race again. If I could just get back to the point where I feel like I'm flowing and enjoying running again, that would be a win for me, and I feel like I'm actually there again. And it is disappointing now that there are no races, because I feel like I'm actually not far away from being in pretty good shape. So anyway, my week, 45 minutes on Monday afternoon after work, 404s. So that's generally a sign for me that things are going okay if I'm doing that sort of on my easy runs again. Tuesday, I looked after Lily, and I was sort of, wasn't super motivated to go out and train by myself. So I messaged Josh Johnson to see what Team Telford were doing, and he said that him and Rory Hunter were doing their own sort of session that afternoon at Thoroughbred Park, which is the local racetrack here. So I met those guys for a warm-up. We warmed up on a golf course close by, and as we got closer to the horse track, Josh said, "Oh, we're technically probably not meant to be in here." And then so we got through the fence, and then there was a groundskeeper there, and we thought, "Oh, no, we're going to get booted off here." But, yeah, the guy didn't say anything. So where they do the session is actually on the inside of the racetrack. There's this gravel path, and I'm guessing that's where, like, the ambulances and stuff drive. And it's a real fine gravel. So the surface is flat and good to run on, but it's a bit slippery. You don't feel like you can get a lot of purchase when you're trying to run quick. Those guys were doing a 20-minute tempo, but because I did a tempo a few days earlier, I stuck to my 5 3-minuters off a minute. And yeah, so I averaged about probably 3:10s for the efforts, and it was probably more of a float than a flat out just slow jog. And it was hard because you're running around in circles, and those guys are sort of continuing at a consistent pace, and it sort of drags you along a bit more. So I was floating at probably 3:45. So 3:16s for the 5 3-minuters, had a few minutes rest, and then I did 5 30-second reps with Josh. They were pretty quick, actually. It sort of reminded me back of doing some quick 200s at the end of training. I was starting to get a little bit lactic. They were off a minute. So that was Tuesday. Wednesday, yeah, worked Wednesday. So organised to meet Rob, who I coach and I've never met before, and another guy, Tony Craig. He is from Queensland. He's run 8:17 in the past, but he's down here. He's part of the army as a dentist, and he's in Canberra for like 6 months. So the three of us ran through Mulligans, did 18.6K at 4:08. So it was, yeah, good to have some company out there. It was probably a little bit too hot for Rob, but I, yeah, certainly wasn't pushing the pace. I was constantly saying, we can go slower, but yeah, it was good to have some company.
He says that though, Moose, when you jog with him, but then he never goes slower.
Oh, yeah.
He always says, we can go slower.
Classic half stepper.
But I'm a step in front of you the whole time. He did it with me that day in Echuca.
Brady, I saw that you commented on Rob Strava saying, did you get dropped? And what did Rob say? That, yeah, it was probably quicker than I expected, but it wasn't my fault.
Yeah, it was 100% not Brad's fault. He couldn't have been clearer with that answer.
Thursday, 4:10s for an hour. Then Friday, ran in the morning here in Canberra. So 35 minutes at 4:14s. Then we headed to the coast. And my session, I actually met Matt Johnson, who lives down there. He's got a bit of a sore foot at the moment. So he rocked up, and there's actually a photo on my Strava. He rocked up to the session. He said, "Oh, I'll ride with you." Rocked up on his mum's bike. It had the basket at the front. It was like probably a 30-year-old bike. Don't think it had gears. So it was actually pretty hard work for him, I think, on the gravel. Yeah, but my session was 20-minute tempo. And I sort of chose here because there's like a 4.75K segment which Matt held. And so I thought, oh, that looks about sort of tempo pace for me. So I'll try and take that Strava segment. Yes, 20-minute tempo, which I averaged 3:14s for. Most of it was on gravel, few rolling hills. Had 5-minute jog back to where there was some hills and did 4 30-second hill sprints. So I felt really good during that session. I was actually chatting to him sort of throughout the tempo. I was super pleased with that. Saturday, did the river run, which starts at Nelligan and runs along the river. And it's one of those runs that's just deceptively hilly. When you're out there, you're like, yeah, I feel like I'm working pretty hard, but it doesn't seem that hilly. And then it's not until you get back and you sort of download the run and it's got like 280 meters of climbing in 14K, and you're like, yeah, it's probably why it was pretty solid. So average 4.10s for that. Listen to the Road to London episode 3. I had a bit of catching up to do there, so that was really enjoyable. I don't listen to podcasts that often when I run. I prefer music, but I really enjoyed that episode that you did, Moose.
Who do you reckon won the banter mate. Battle?
Nick Earl was pretty good. I've got to say he's quite witty.
He's
quite witty.
He's quick.
Yeah, he doesn't need a lot of time.
Witty doesn't beat aggression.
No, but see, that's why you're not witty enough, so you need to be aggressive to compete.
Yeah, and it works. It scares people.
Anyway, so that was the morning run. And then in the afternoon, watched the Raiders on TV. And then, ran 35 minutes just around Surfside, which is dead flat on the roads. Found out that afternoon that Kenny Rogers had passed away. And funnily enough, a Kenny Rogers song came on and, sort of got rolling, 3:58 for 35 minutes. Felt really good. And then Sunday, so when I trained with Josh Johnson on Tuesday, I told him that I was heading down the coast and his parents have a place down there. So him and a few others decided to drive down after training on Saturday. So I met him, Rory Hunter, another guy named Ruben, and Josh's girlfriend. But Ruben and Rory were taking it super easy. So it was just myself and Josh pretty much from the first K. He wanted to do about an hour 45. And this run escalated big time. I didn't know what, it just got quicker and quicker and quicker. And so I ended up averaging 3:52s for 2 hours. So around 31K. And it's a pretty hilly run, 525 metres of climbing. Did that completely fasted. And, the hills, we definitely ran the hills hard, but on the flats we were able to chat away. So I got a lot of confidence from that. Doing that fasted, not completely blowing up, and running that pace over that sort of elevation is a good sign. So things are going pretty well.
It's up and about, Moose. He's real up.
Making me sick.
He's going all right. What about the gap on that run on Strava is 3:41 average for 31K?
Yeah, it's pretty hilly.
We get it, mate. We get it. You're going well.
You and Josh Johnson, best mates, training partners now.
I just thought it'd be good to do some runs with some people occasionally. So that's why I reached out on the Tuesday. But then today I trained, trained with that Tony Craig. I think maybe once every couple of weeks or once every 3 weeks, it'd be good to jump in with Team Telford or another group just to mix it up a little bit.
He's a bit of a mad snake too, isn't he? Talking about aggression.
Josh.
Yeah. Didn't he get a punch on once at the end of a race?
He's matured a lot, but he's a bit of a loose cannon when it comes to, he races aggressively and he obviously long runs aggressively as well because he was pretty much just pacemaking me the whole way. I was just like, God, did you realise that K was 3:39? So, anyway, all good.
It's the perfect combination. How many K you do? 140.
143, yeah. It was pretty pretty heavily loaded at the back end.
And all very quick. I'm just loading up our Strava group at the moment. You got to be close to taking the win for fastest pace for the week with that long run in there.
Not with those guys that are running 3:45s.
Oh, fifth Brad, 4:01 average. Yeah.
Who's got it? Who's got the win there?
It's always European guy smashes.
Is it Moose, probably Moose's mate?
No, this is Theus Najil.
Kicked him out of the group.
This guy's from Denmark.
Theus?
Yeah, you know
he, him? He ran 2 fucking 10.
This guy is legit, yeah.
Seville Marathon.
Yeah, Denmark. I didn't know he ran that quick. Why are these good people joining our group?
Yeah.
There you go.
It's better to be the top dog, isn't it? That's why you move to fucking Moema. Yeah.
That's why you look up the heaps good runners group. I think I'm just the fastest on that one.
Are you?
Oh, you've done your homework.
Just refreshes it Sunday night.
That's all that matters now, isn't it, Strava?
There's not much
we've got left.
I'll kick off my week. Started Monday morning, lovely morning for a jog. Did 14K at 4:18 pace. Then in the afternoon, did 8K and did some strides. Just did 600 metres fast on the oval with a massive tailwind. And this was a bit of a reset for me. This is the first fast stuff I did. since Rotterdam kind of got postponed. So I just need something just to tick the legs over, just to reset, start fresh on the Monday. And this was definitely it. It was good to be going fast again because all I was doing was jogging for those couple of days. Yeah, pretty much for like 5 days straight. So I was pretty fresh. They felt good to go fast again. Tuesday, I had Moose Fartlek, the old 3 minute steady, 1 minute jog, 1 minute hard, 1 minute jog times five, 30 minutes. Session PB, boys, 9.32K in 30 minutes with 10 minutes of that jogging, Bradley. Probably in 28-30 shape, I reckon, going by that. Probably a Moose Fartlek PB too, I reckon, Moose. Anyone gone?
Fastest has anyone ever done it?
Furthest everyone's ever gone in 30 minutes, Moose Fartlek, you reckon?
Nothing counts when you do it in Moama, though.
No, you see the loop I did on it? It's like a 5K block. This one's legit.
Doesn't matter.
I have to check what Ali's done. She might have you there.
Yeah, anyway, I was pretty happy with it. 3 minute reps are like around three or five pace, and then fast 1 minute is kind of going at about. It was probably close to a float. I didn't realize until I checked it afterwards, but most of the 1 minute recoveries were like 4:10 pace. So that just felt good.
Just on this, yep. Can I just highlight one training session from today? You may have already been part of some banter, but I had a screenshot sent through to me. There was a certain runner out there that ran a monofartlek today.
No, I'm going to talk about this guy. Yeah. Keep going.
This was his first 90 seconds, average pace, 2:53. His second 90 seconds, which is supposed to be a float, 2:56.
There's a story behind this, though. You know that segment? He was chasing a segment because Andy Buchanan took it off him, the wedge. It's a real prestigious segment in Bendigo. So he's just planning to fang the first like 3K of his monofartlek to get that segment back.
Petty people.
That's all we got now, Moose. Driver segments. We're talking about the beast here, ladies and gents. I'll get to him later on in my weekly recap.
Brady, with that session, are you finding, like, how good is this time of year? Like, the mornings are amazing. It's not windy. And this was the whole thing that was saying, like, a few months back when it was hot, saying, you know, you're still as fit as ever. It's just that the weather conditions impact training, impact races. But come March, you'll be basically hitting the ball out of the park because of the weather, basically. It's such a good time of the year to run.
Yeah. I didn't actually feel that good in that session until I checked it afterwards and then checked what I'd done previously. I'm like, whoa, that was the same effort I've been putting in, but the weather was just so much cooler. And I also enjoy not having to worry about snakes and stuff. So I go more bush trails and like single track. So that's also more enjoyable as well than sticking to like the main roads and stuff to avoid snakes. That was Tuesday. Did 8K in the afternoon. It was a bit of shakey as well. 4:29 pace. Wednesday, easy 16K in the morning, easy 30 minutes in the afternoon. Pretty similar Thursday, 14K in the morning, 7K in the afternoon. Had an extra recovery day because I was teed up to meet the Beast in Bendigo Saturday. So Friday was 14K in the morning and 7K in the afternoon. And then I was going to be in Bendigo Saturday, so the Beast and I kind of done a bit of a compromise. He didn't want to do my session, I didn't want to do his session, so we kind of merged our sessions together. Did 30 minutes at a 3:21 average. Then we did 2 minutes float and then 2 by 10 minutes. First 10 minutes was 3:07 average pace, 3 minutes jog. And then the last 10 minutes was 3:02 average pace. The Beast was pretty solid. Took a while to get rid of him in those last 10 minute kind of reps. Just got away from him. All up, that was like nearly 17K at like 3:17 pace. Felt good. Like I've literally never been fitter than I am at the moment. So I kind of enjoy doing workouts at the moment and just having them kind of under control. We're going to do that down the lake in Bendigo. I thought everyone, like Echuca and Moama has been pretty dead just because there's no tourists coming to town and everyone's kind of laying low. So all our kind of cafes and restaurants, this is before they all had to shut down, were really quiet. And then when I got to Bendigo, everyone was just doing their own thing down there, people everywhere. The lake where we're going to do this workout was actually so busy that we couldn't like comfortably run at kind of 3:20 pace without taking people out and having to zigzag and stuff. So we kind of did this on a bike track at White Hills, Epsom Way, if people are familiar with that area. Bit windy, but otherwise it was good. Had some good tailwinds, had some hard headwinds. Sunday, got out for 2 hours with the Beast again, mainly Matt Skepsi and Stephen Van Reeves and Milko. There was a few guys in our kind of group, but most of the time I was up the front with the Beast. I was pretty dusty. Had a few couple glasses of red wine the night before. Did 2 hours. You had me down to do like 28K, Moose, but it was only like 26K. 4:34 average. 390 metres, Brad a climber, not as much as you, 168k a week. Happy with it. Kind of, I think if I can do 160k weeks, two good sessions in a long run, I'm going to keep myself pretty fit through these interesting times.
Hey, how many people on that long run with you?
I think there was about seven who started, and then, yeah, like the Beast and I were kind of off the front. Matt Skepsi is really good. He's a trail runner. He won that Warburton Trail Fest thing the other day. He kind of caught us going down one of the downhills. And then, yeah, probably three more guys that we probably were with after the first 3K. We're practicing our social distancing, though. Is that why you're asking?
Oh, I was just wondering if you attended like an organised group run or not.
Yeah, well, they meet at Sunday. They call it Bendigo Sunday Sevens or whatever it is, something like that. I actually started late because they start right on 7 o'clock and I get there at about 6:59 and then I still have to do my shoelaces up and stuff. So I had to give them a head start, caught up to them.
They don't wait. They don't give you 1 minute.
No, they go right on 7. Yeah, even if you're a visitor from town coming down.
Even if they can see you doing up your shoelaces.
Yeah, Bendigo's brutal, mate. What about Andy?
I reckon Andy Buchanan rocks up, they wait for him.
They would, actually. What about Buchanan's been, he's got a niggly sorting out, so the Beast has just remade the loop. Like, he's just, like, this loop's been going for years and years and years. Andy's not there this week. The Beast has changed it. Whole new loop. Well, not a whole new loop, but a little adjustment to it for about 3Ks. He's just
could
running
be Bendigo. Could be a street fight in Bendigo yeah, coming up.
We ran that 14:14 or something for 5K the other week, and now he's smashing on a fart like at 3 minute K pace. He's, yeah, as I said, he's a beast.
How about if, say, you're his bitch out there, he tells you what to do?
What do you mean?
On those long runs.
Oh, yeah, I was just hanging on. I was trying to put the brakes on, like, yeah, I was just, like, three steps behind him, like, let's just slow things down. And then I did notice, because he did, like, an extra 5 or 6K to me, like, after I finished my 2 hours, he just started rolling, like, 350s, whereas I was battling at the end.
Can train.
He'll come out of this corona problem. He's the fittest guy in Australia, I reckon. Anyway, let's thank some Patreon supporters, and then we're going to go Moose on the Loose, because you've got to get out of here, Moose.
I do. Got to get back to the old work situation. So I'm going to thank Oliver Bater. London, England, UK. 39.51, 10K. 127.54 at the Hilly Windsor Half. Did you call it the Hilly Windsor Half,
just,
or is it?
Just copied and pasted that from his Strava. Not sure if the Windsor Half is hilly.
Maybe he's just put a bit of mayo on the Windsor Half there.
Could.
Seems to spend a bit of time in Hong Kong, studied at the University of Oxford, went to Harrow School. Yeah, sounds like could be a smart chap.
Smart guy, I reckon. He's probably flying in and out of Hong Kong doing some real smart kind of job.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it could be a trader.
Could be a financial trader, you mean, on the markets, a stockbroker.
Some sort of trader, you know, like trades goods also.
Yeah, it could be trading spices or something. Gold, anything.
Just do your boy.
Bitcoin. Brad, who you got?
My shout out this week's to Logan Smith. He's also from the UK, lives in Bristol. He's the general manager at the Gangway Micro Pub. So I guess with all the shutdowns over there, Logan would be struggling a little bit, probably not a lot of work to be doing. He's run 14:31 for 5K, won the Run Norwich 10K in 31:41. And I believe that's the 10K that Nick Earl has won in the past. Got some good ink on his arm and wins a few races over there going by his Facebook account. So thanks for your support, Logan, and I hope you're doing well over there in the UK along with Oliver as well. I think they're copping it pretty bad.
Yeah, thanks, guys. I want to thank Nick Delaney from Toowoomba, Queensland. Has a real good moustache, Moose. You'd like this. You're a fan of the Mo. He's got a good one, Nick. He ran an hour 43 at the Sunshine Coast Half Marathon in 2019 and did the Peak to Park 10K race. I think this was last weekend or the weekend before, so probably one of the last opportunities to race for a while. He did that 10K in 41:15, which was 6 minutes quicker than last year on the same course. So Nick's hitting some form. He's also ran, can someone shut that cat up? He's also ran 19:58 for 5K, enjoys a chocolate milkshake, and he ran at Mulligan's, Brad, on the 23rd of February at 8:14 a.m.
I didn't know that, and I read this today and had a look at which loop he did. So, Yeah, he did a couple of the real tough climbs that I actually haven't done for a few years. So he's a harder man than I am.
Yeah, I was scrolling through, saw a photo in front of the Mulligan's board, and I was like, this can't be true, but it was.
Yeah, good
I can't
man.
Believe you've made that place famous.
Yeah, it's a great place to train.
I can't wait to get out there.
I've been thinking of starting up Mulligan's Flat Track Club.
Oh, yeah, you should. Start a Strava group. You can see if you're the fastest average time each week around there.
You should do a group long run there. Well, not at the moment. You shouldn't. Yeah, don't especially after that. This next section.
Yeah.
Moose on the loose.
Yeah, well, good segue. You should not start a fucking group run because it's dumb. I couldn't believe it on Sunday morning when I saw, when there was just group runs going on all over the place. You both see that? Organised group runs? Oh, you were part of one, Brady, so this might hit home to you.
Hit me hard. Go for it.
Moose, well, what classes is a group run? He's like three or four guys?
I'm saying that's okay. I reckon organized like group runs where you're actively encouraging people to show up as a group is not a fucking good idea, right? Because people sort of said, oh, there's a race cancellation. Why don't we organize a big group run? Well, the reason is because the race cancellation, it was for a reason, a very good reason. The spread of this virus, obviously very important to control, and as a exercising athlete, like, yeah, you might be in the fresh air, but your spit and your saliva, it's really easy to like pass that along, and so we're trying to stop that. So when someone cancels a race, doesn't give you a license, or it's not a fucking good idea to go and organize your own group run. So selfish, one, surely you can get through running in very small groups.
Shut up, Vince.
Run through in very small groups or by yourself for this period of time that we have to. If you have to run with a big group of people, well, you don't have to. It's not a fucking thing. So don't do it. It's selfish. It's ridiculous. I don't know. I was fuming on Sunday afternoon when I'm looking at all these group runs that have happened and people actively like creating groups after being advised not to. That's just, I just can't believe it. It's like you're as dumb as the people rocking up to Bondi Beach, except probably worse because you're organizing everyone to come together and you're sweating and spitting all over the place. Like
snot rockets as well, Moose. People love firing off snot rockets on the Sunday long run. Bushman's blows. Yeah.
I mean, shit, it's you might say, oh, we've kept our distance. Bullshit. You ran for 2 hours together on a fucking single track. I know that you didn't. There's spots there where you're close together. And I'm not pointing any group out in particular, but you could see where people ran, and it was with big group. Not a good idea. Really frustrating to me, considering that what's happening by extending the time that this virus creates social disruption and puts us in periods of distancing and regulations and social isolation is costing people their jobs, their livelihood, their businesses. And you think it's okay to go out there as a hobby and run with other people to fucking further increase the risk of this becoming more of an issue? That's just fucking selfish.
Yeah, I agree. Could I just make this point that Stephen Van Rees, the guy we're running with, he actually made a point at the start to say like that kind of stuff, like let's not be doing this, like spread out and stuff like that on our Sunday one. He's a smart so cookie.
Sunday morning we had like, when I got to the group, Ramona was on the bike and it was Watto and I knew of one other person there, and in the end I think we had four runners, and to me I'm like, oh, this is borderline right now. Like, I'm not comfortable really running with many more people than this together. And I thought, a little bit sort of dodgy.
I think a lot of it comes from uneducation as well and not knowing. Like, yeah.
Mate, there is no fucking way you don't know what you're not supposed to do right now.
Oh, but the messages from the government are confusing. Like, that's one thing that's been all over the shop. But I think just people in general, like, were thinking it's like the flu. They were thinking it's only an old people's thing. And, like, as we go further, and it's not an excuse, but I'm just thinking that maybe people just don't, like, people aren't doing this intentionally to cause more drama. They just don't have the knowledge there.
Well, yeah, so that's the other thing. Like, This isn't a political podcast, right?
Yeah, yeah. I don't want to talk about this stuff too long either.
For me, what this has sort of alerted me to is the fact that we do not have a leader who's strong enough to come out and be clear in his statements and strong enough in his statements. And it's so convoluted, the message that we're getting. I'm not saying that's okay. Like, I still knew. I don't know how you wouldn't have known that a social gathering of 30 people is not, it's not fucking okay to do on a Sunday morning for a hobby. That's not okay. But yeah, you're right. The message is out there, especially because this fucking dipshit went to a massive Hillsong gathering and planned to go to the NRL footy 1 week before the socializer, like every event started getting cancelled. To me, then, like, yeah.
And schools, so schools are still open here in Canberra. Like, I'm meant to be going into work tomorrow. So it's sort of like, and that's where the mixed messages are coming through. It's like, well, if, you know, teachers can go and be, you know, in contact with potentially 800 students during a day, then what's 20 people going for a run? What's your take on like distance groups training together during this period?
I think I don't think it's necessary, to be honest. And I know there's a lot out there that are still doing it. And
so
I
respect MTC still training together?
Nah, not on Jordan Williams' Strava today. I think he said trains off group training.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I know, like, I've seen certain groups that have, and maybe they're running like in separate, but I just don't think it's a good idea to be doing that right now. And I don't think it's a good look to be encouraging people to come and do that in the one spot. Like, it's time and place for that stuff, and this is not it. And yeah, like, some people think, oh, we need running as a thing right now, we need to get people together, it'll be good for the group, everyone's morale will lift. Well, yeah, maybe that might happen, but at the same time, it's a fucking bad idea. So do it another way.
Yeah.
Yep.
It's probably not so much of an issue. Like, we're used to doing a lot of sessions on our own. So for us, it's like sort of business as usual, but there's probably a lot of people out there that, you know, haven't had to do sessions on their own because they've been part of groups for so long. So it's probably challenging for them.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it might be, but that's life. And this shit is unprecedented.
Yeah.
So just because you haven't trained by yourself before doesn't mean that you can't do it. Think of it as an opportunity. Like, this is a time so you can go and chill out, use it more as a meditative type thing, not a group social thing. It's not a time for socializing with your running.
And at the end of the day, it's just running. Compared to some of the things that are going on in the world, people losing their jobs, houses, lives.
Mm. Exactly. That's a bit of piss.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a bit I'm struggling with. Yeah,
it's disrespectful to those people when you get together and do a group run like that. That's what pisses me off the most. Is I got friends losing their jobs, houses uncertain, and you're out there just basically flopping around like fucking morons together. Anyway, I had this on Sunday. I had it. Yeah.
good one, Moose. The Moose is back.
Moose is back.
All right. I'm worked up about this one. That's good. I'm worked up.
Yeah. Well, I think you look at where we're heading at the moment and you look at the other countries that have headed in a similar direction, and we could be in quite a bit of trouble down here because we're quite naive and it's still happening.
People with their head in the sand pretending it's not going to happen. That's what this is.
Yeah. Hey, before we let you go, what's coming up in your life?
Well, my prediction is tomorrow morning we won't be opening the doors of the store, so we will be operating the store basically as a warehouse. We have a new online store, so that has taken me and the team a lot of fucking man hours the last couple of days. It's been pretty – I'm not good at IT, and so building this thing was not an easy process, and I've been in front of the computer screen a lot. But we got some cool shit up there. It's the running company – Ballarat Shopify site. So there's no good website. Like, you're gonna have to click it off one of the links. We'll put it up on Facebook on the Inside Running podcast page. But this is how we survive now. The environment's changed, and we can still — what we want to do as a business is we still want to help you with your shoe choices. but at this time it's going to be over the phone. Like, you can check out our range on this online. We're still putting it up every hour. That's what I'm off to. I've got another couple of hours tonight putting more shit up on the website. But you're going to be able to look at what we got. You're going to call us, hopefully email us, and we can talk to you about what shoe might work and what will be best for you. So we're not just some nerd, fat dipshits in a warehouse somewhere. We're actual runners and we're here to help. So we want to sort of maintain our service level, but at the same time, be online. Can we do it? We'd be one of the first to ever do it, I reckon.
Yeah, for sure. Even if you I saw something on Twitter the other day about like runners supporting local running stores, and it was like, even if you don't need a new pair of shoes, buy the pair of shoes that you're just always training, because usually as diehard runners, we just wear the same pair over and over, and just put a pair at the top of the wardrobe, just stock up. It's a good way to support people at this time.
That's right. Yeah, gift vouchers for when the time comes later on. There'll be some businesses go under, without a doubt. There'll be businesses go under, new businesses that have had a rough trot for one reason or another. They're not going to get through this. I just know it. Even like a successful business will have trouble making it through. And that's like, that's just how it is. It's just the nature of it. And we can do as much as we can to help out. Like, from like Bree and I, what we do is, We try to support look, cafes. Instead of making a lunch each day, we're going to go to a different cafe in the area, get a takeaway, get dinner from restaurants who are doing takeaway options, small businesses. So if you have the means to support people right now, now is the time to support your friends and your community.
And Brad and I was talking off air before, like musicians, artists, things like that. I know Benny Walker, we use his song for the start of the for start of the show, done it for 125 episodes, plus all the other extra stuff that we use that song for. Just all gigs cancelled, just no good.
Yeah.
So if you're out there and you've got a spare $1.50, I know how many people download this show every week, and if a quarter of you guys buy one of Benny Walker's songs, that will help him and his young family, or just, he said, stream the shit out of it on Spotify and that, because then the festival people that book them for gigs, they see how many plays you've got on that on your Spotify kind of songs, and then they use that to book you for gigs. So if you're out there and you got $1.50 to spare, help him out.
What's his name on Spotify? Benny Walker? Ben Walker?
Benny Walker.
Benny Walker. All right.
Benny Walker. Got a new song at the moment. Just a new single the other day. Album coming soon. Probably don't buy the one that we use. We just use that all the time. Buy a different one of
the
songs.
That's got to be the best one.
He's got some good ones there. Got some good ones. Anyway.
I really like that one. Yeah. I'm a big fan of that song.
Yeah, he's got some good tracks on there. All right, so you're gone. We'll talk to you next week. Have fun. Yep. Bradley and I, we're going to talk through some short runner news, one listener question, and then we're going to get out of here as well. Bradley, first bit of running news. This could change tomorrow by the time people listen to this or whenever they listen to the show. The Australian Olympic Committee said on Monday it could not assemble a team for the 2020 Tokyo Olympics due to the coronavirus outbreak, and that its athletes should prepare for the games to be postponed to 2021. I think we also joined Canada, who said that they wouldn't be sending a team if the Olympics were to go ahead in 2020. And then veteran International Olympic Committee member, this guy's got the best name in the business, Dick Pound, told USA Today Sports that the 2020 Tokyo Olympic Games are going to be postponed amid the coronavirus pandemic. So he's kind of broke that news, you know, before it's kind of officially come out. It's bound to happen, isn't it, Brad?
Yeah, like, and I think it's, yeah, I think it's great. And the quicker that they make the announcement, the quicker people can then relax and make, I guess, plans for 12 months' time. There's just so many other more important things going on in the world at the moment. And by the sounds of it, this stuff isn't like it's not a two-week thing. Like, you hear all the politicians saying, if we close down borders or if we close down schools, it's not 2 weeks, it's months. Mm. So I did see something, I think, today on Sean Whip's Instagram about why they're taking so long to make an announcement. And it's something about the contracts with, like, the organising committee and the IOC and who makes the call first. But, yeah, like, I think it's inevitable that it's going to be announced.
Yeah, I tried to read that. It's pretty heavy stuff. We'll put it in the show notes, but it kind of talks about if Japan break the contract and cancel it or postpone it, or if the IOC do it, then there's kind of massive, you know, legal kind of implications depending on who does it and how that flow and effect can that impact like broadcast rights and things like that. So it's quite interesting if you're if you want to know why this delay is happening on any announcement. Someone who would have been at the Olympic Games but won't be because they won't happen. Genevieve Lacaz went out to go around the tan in Melbourne, the Botanical Gardens, this morning, Tuesday, the 24th of March. She broke the record for one hot lap. It's 3.827 kilometres. The loop got a hill there up Anderson Street, then it kind of rolls down the last K and a half, 2K. Bradley, you've run there before. She ran 11.54 to beat Sarah Jamieson's time back in 2006 of 11.57. So that record has stood for 14 years. Sarah Jamieson used to be the Australian 1,500 metre and maybe mile record holder. So pretty quick. Sinead Diver was also there as well. She ran 12.08, so not far behind. And they had Sarah Billings doing some pacemaking, I think, to get them to the top of Anderson Street Hill before they came down. Stewie was meant to be there from all reports and wasn't because he didn't feel up for it mentally after learning of the impending postponement of the Tokyo Olympics. I took this article from maybe the Herald Sun or somewhere like that, so it's good it's getting some mainstream media. Craig Mottram's record around there is 10.08, so he would have been, you'd think Stewie would have been really close to having a crack at that. What did you think of it, Brad, when you saw this stuff come up today?
Yeah, I wonder, though, whether, like, to get your name on top of the list, does it have to be, like, sanctioned or, you know, can they, will this, you know, so will Jen's name be at the top?
Yeah, I think they had like an official timekeeper because when Mottram set that one, he actually did that when he was training with Richmond Footy Club. Like they kind of had a time trial or something one day and he kind of gave him a head start and then pulled them all in and smashed them. And yeah, they must have had an official timer there. I don't think you need to get the course sanction, obviously, because it's just kind of one lap, but I'm not sure if you need people at different points to make sure no one's cutting through the middle. This is like a big deal in Melbourne, the 10. People love getting around this kind of thing and I like it because it's new, different stuff that athletes are kind of doing at the moment because they can't race. They can kind of have a go at kind of records and stuff like this, whereas probably Gregson's season doesn't usually allow her to do stuff like this. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I felt like when I saw it pop up today and it was kind of everywhere and well promoted and well shared, it was a bit like watching the AFL and the NRL that there was just something a bit weird for me, and this is just my opinion, celebrating a amazing athletic performance, knowing, like Moose was just talking about, when like mates are losing their jobs and people are, you know, losing their houses through mortgages and kind of people are dying. And we're kind of, maybe I've consumed too much media and I'm too anxious and worried and I don't froth on running stuff at the moment. It was hard for me to kind of get up and about seeing all this amazing stuff on social media. And that's just my thoughts. Like, I still think it's cool and it's interesting that people are doing different stuff.
Yeah, I don't have an issue with it at all. Like, you know, I think it's great that they're, you know, if they're fit, why not sort of let out some frustration that the Olympics are going to be, you know, postponed. But I think the 10, it's, like, it has cultural significance to Melbourne. Like, if you're in Sydney or in Canberra, quickest times around the 10 mean absolutely nothing to anyone up here. Like, I've run hard around the 10 once, and you know, you're dodging people. Like, so it wasn't if the 10 was closed when you're doing it. But you know, if there's a time to do it, now's probably the time, because I'd imagine there's a lot less people around the 10 than there would normally be.
Yeah.
So it's probably a smart move to do it now.
Yeah. And I think like super elite athletes like Jen probably need little kind of things on their calendar to get up for, because they're so used to performing at super high levels and that's kind of their job. And yeah, but I wonder what the next thing is. Like, do they tackle something else, or does Lyndon Hall or Jess Hull, if she ever comes back, do they start going, all right, well, I'm going to have a crack at that now because that might be the only thing I can do at the moment. So yeah, it'd be interesting to see how all this stuff unfolds in the next coming weeks and months.
Yeah, and I think things like Strava segments are keeping a lot of people motivated as well, just going out and having a crack at certain things. So really, it's whatever it's whatever floats your boat and whatever gets you up, you know, to get out running. But just getting back to that, the Olympics being postponed, it's going to be interesting. Like, some athletes will be absolutely gutted, and there'll be other athletes that'll actually be quite happy about it. So, like, somebody like Jess Stenson, for example, you know, for her, this gives her a lot more time to get fit and get out a marathon if it's in a year's time. Other people that are battling injuries at the moment, they're like, well, this, you know, I thought my Olympics were over and I was no chance, whereas now that it's, you know, probably going to be postponed for 12 months, maybe I'm a chance now.
Yeah, like Maddie Heiner, who's come back from a surgery and probably trying to run it out of weeks to kind of get the training in. Yeah.
But then you feel sorry for the likes of, like, you know, the people that have already qualified and, you know, like, even like Liam, for example, runs that, you know, great race in Lake Biwa, which pretty much seals the deal, whereas now he has to pretty much sit anxiously for another year, knowing that the likes of Harry Summers could come out, or Joel Tobin White, or whoever else, whereas he was pretty much a shoo-in now. He was a shoo-in, you know, 3 weeks ago.
He's still in the number one spot, though. I'd be more concerned for those people that are holding on to that third spot at the moment, like, you know, an Ali when Jess comes back, or Millie's goes around again, or, but I think Ali can still go much quicker as well. Or like Elisa Waitman being a year on, or, it's an interesting one. Yeah.
But on the flip side of that, the last thing you want, like, I know Olympics only come around every 4 years and people put so much effort into going. The last thing you want is to go to an Olympic Games where there's an asterisk next to it, where you've been selected because, you know, people haven't been able to race because, you know, races have been shut down, or athletes have been quarantined and haven't been able to train properly, so they're going to the Olympics a little bit underdone. So if you go to the Olympics and you perform well, you want to know that you've done it against the best of the best, and everybody's had the best opportunity to prepare for those Olympic Games. So I think it's a good idea.
Yeah. Listener question. Why don't you do one from Supreet?
Yep.
Got three in there. I didn't know if we'd be able to talk for that long tonight, so I put three in, but we only need one.
Yeah, okay. We'll see how we go, see how long this one takes. So I'm in the best shape of my life, especially running-wise, but now all my races are postponed indefinitely, which brings me to my question. Can I claim PBs from time trials? I've always said you can only claim times from races, but these circumstances are unique. Good question.
Yeah.
Are you going to go first, or am I going to go first?
Well, at this stage, I'm going to say no. You cannot from a time trial. But I did like that last sentence he put in. I've always said you can only claim times from races, but these circumstances are unique. If this circumstance that we're living in at the moment lasts 6, 8, 10, 12 months, my answer might change here. Because your time trial might become more legit, or there might be no more opportunities for you. It could be at the end of your running, or the shape of your life, or, you know, you got a baby due and things are about to change. So my answer could change in a couple of months if we had this same question. But I think time trials can't be claimed because there's so many little factors that can come in and out of it. Like, for example, if I've thought about getting a mate on a bike and just sitting on the back wheel for the whole duration of the distance. Say I was going to go out and do a 10K or 15K or even a 5K. Whereas in a race, when you do set your PBs, I know none of my PBs, I've had anyone right in front of me setting the exact pace I needed to get the best out of myself for that whole duration and distance. And I also think in time trials, you can control when you do them. So you pick perfect weather days, whereas that doesn't happen with races. And you can also pick who's around you and, you know, what that situation is. Whereas in races, you've got to be doing tactical stuff as well. It's not all just set up perfectly for you like a time trial possibly can. So I reckon they're good to kind of check your current fitness level, especially if you do the same 5K one once a month or whatever it is, and make that a training PB or a CR or whatever it is. But I don't think you can say, this time trial PB is better than my racing PB at this stage. This is March, maybe in September. I might change my mind. What do you reckon?
Yeah, I agree. And like most of the time, if you're doing a time trial, the courses, like, are they legit? Like, are you just going purely off Strava, off your Garmin or your GPS watch? Because GPS watches aren't 100% accurate. So You know, like if I go down to Yarrabee Pond and just run as hard as I can until my watch clicks over 5K, have I actually run 5K? I probably not. I'm probably a little bit short. Whereas if I do something on the track, I still would. So if I ran 5K on the track, knowing that it's exactly 5K, I still wouldn't claim it as a PB. But if I ran a PB during a time trial, it would give me a hell of a lot of confidence that when next time I go and race, knowing that, well, I can do it. So psychologically, I think there's a benefit from going out and doing time trials and potentially running a PB, but I don't think you can claim it.
Yeah, and especially if you have people there as well. Like I often find if I've got someone on the bike, I can go to another level. Like it's something about doing a time trial with people there and time trials. Whereas if you're on time trials solo, and then you rock up to a race, you'll go to a whole nother level as well because you've done that by yourself and then all of a sudden you've got people around.
Yeah, but that's definitely like the instance. If you can do something in a time trial, especially if you know that the course is that distance, yeah, officially you can't claim it, but it certainly gives you confidence knowing, and because that's half the battle. Like remember that saying, it's like it's always easier to get back to where you've been than to get there in the first place, because it changes mentally that once you've done it once, you go, well, I can do that again.
Mm.
So if you've done something in training, then yeah, it's easier then to go, okay, well, I know I can do it. I just need now a race. So question on this though, Brady, if I go out and I smash out what I think's a 5K around Yarrabee and try and break 15 minutes, do I qualify for my Macca's Burgers?
No, well, have you got somewhere in Canberra that is a measured 5K course, like a crit track or something like that? Like, I know we've got this. Yeah, have you got something?
Oh, we've got athletics tracks, but they're all closed.
Yeah, you don't have any grass tracks. They've got spray paint on it.
What if I ran a 14:50? Give my a 10 second buffer over 5K.
2 seconds a K, maybe. Yeah, close. I just think that's like, if you're going to do time trials, try doing one somewhere that's been measured. So most towns have got like a crit course. I know we've got one that's 500 meters and be boring as doing 10 laps of that. But I'd rather do that knowing that that's been measured by a professional and there's a line down there rather than going off a Garmin split. If you've got a little athletics track that you can get onto, do 12 and a half laps of 5K. Even like a car racing track. We're talking about Sandown the other week, how that's like 6.1K. If you're going to do a time trial, it'd be good to do something on something that's already been measured by a professional. So, yeah, good luck with that, Supreeth. Just, you'll know anyway. Like, yeah, you'll just be able to feel it. And it kind of makes me excited for when races are back on, that you can just, yeah, that's when you can start claiming stuff. All right, Bradley, what's coming up? You're hosting Road to Nowhere Wednesday night.
Yeah, so that'd be good. We'll keep it going, see what they've been up to this week. And, yeah, probably ask them a few questions as well. We've got a heap of listener questions came in to ask them all. So I found it really entertaining, actually. I listened to the Road to Nowhere when did we listen to that? Yesterday, actually. Yeah, so they're really good together, those three.
They are. Like, I put a question on Patreon just saying, like, hey, who wants to send in some questions? Like, I'm not sure what I'm going to be able to talk to these guys about now they don't have a race to prepare for. And we got to, like, one question because they're so detailed with their weeks and they've just got these little in-jokes. You still feel weird being there, though. It feels like you're gate-crashing, like, a whole different podcast.
Yeah, yeah. I reckon Joel's pretty pumped that the Olympics have been or are likely to be postponed for a year.
Yeah, he's one of those ones in that boat, isn't he? That's like,
yeah.
When he heard London was called off, just a double fist pump in the air. Ali shattered, he's all about it. And then you got Nick Earl just doing whatever he's doing. I've been in the shed the whole last week. I didn't go anywhere. I went to the supermarket once and saw the checkout girl. That was the only person I saw for like 6 days other than my son and my wife at home here. So I've been in the shed because I didn't want to go to school, so now schools are shut. So I'm working on a stack of bonus content for Patreon, trying to really say thank you to the people that support us on Patreon. I've been doing these Friends of the Show podcasts where I pretty much just go through the Skype contacts and I just call someone that we've had on the podcast before, someone that we talk about a lot on the show, someone that the listeners are familiar with, and just do like a really, I wouldn't even say it's a part two interview. It's more just a bit of a chat. I don't prepare any notes. I don't tell you who it is until they pick up. So like literally you hear the Skype ringing, the Skype dial tone, and then, You just someone picks up. So there's three of those. I did two last week and one today. Three of those on there for the people that would love to support us on Patreon Extra Elite. There's heaps of bonus content coming for you because we've got time on our hands. And yeah, we really, really appreciate this support at this time. So I've been having fun with that and looking forward to doing a few more of those as they go.
I listened to the first one that you put up.
How good was it?
Yeah, so Viv and I, on the way back from the coast yesterday, we had that playing while we're driving. So,
and you liked it?
I did.
You actually interviewed that person the first time, and I was a bit jealous because I knew that person, and I'm like, I love listening to you interview him, and then I'm like, I want to go at this now.
Yeah. He was very nice to me towards the end.
He was nice to you, yeah. Yeah, patrons who have listened will know who we're talking about, but if you want to sign up, it's all over there. I reckon I'm probably going to upload. It'd be close to 5-6 hours a week of content at the moment. So if you love your podcast, you do a lot of stuff solo. If you're one of those people sitting on the fence, should you support us or not, now's the perfect time in these strange times. This week's interview, Zach Bitter, the world 12-hour. He ran 168 Ks in 12 hours around a track the same day that he ran 100 miles. So what's that, 160 Ks, Bradley, on the track? He set the world records for 12 hours and 100 miles. He ran the 100 miles, so 160K at 4:13 per K pace, which is incredible. I caught up with him about a week and a half ago. That's like sub-3-hour marathons, just churning them out. One of the biggest names in the world in kind of ultra-running kind of scene. It's been on Joe Rogan podcast, like the world's biggest podcast, 2 times, so we kind of had a bit of a chat about that. Talked about all things training, what you got to do to prepare for stuff like that. Talked about his upcoming race schedules, which was interesting because I think the day I called him, Trump had just started closing borders in the US. And yeah, it's kind of fascinating hearing how these guys operate and how they prepare for these longer distance races. So I hope you enjoy this one. Bradley, what's coming up?
Road to Nowhere tomorrow night, and then pretty sure I'm interviewing Ryan Gregson on Friday. So those that listen to this before Friday, if you have any questions that you'd like me to ask Ryan, the Australian 1500 meter record holder, flick them through to Facebook or Patreon or wherever you want to get hold of us, and I'll add it to the list.
You got to go deep on Rio 2016, that 1500 meter final. That was great. That's when Centro won off the slot, and he was there and he got checked or something, didn't he, and kind of spat at the back and then missed the move. Remember that?
Yeah, I do.
Hear his insight into that race. First like Australian 1500 meter finalist in like a stack of years as well. Been around a long time. That'd be interesting to hear. Alrighty, we're done.
What are you up to, mate?
I'm literally like Victorian schools are shut, so it got serious real quick. I was telling you off air before, like I often say on the show, we've got this Airbnb apartment, which is a bit of our income here. And a lot of people come up for weddings to Echuca Moama, and we kind of just had 12 cancellations in the space of like 2 days. So lost a bit of income there, and our schools are shut down. So losing a bit of income there. So I'm kind of just thinking about, ways to get creative and try to, do some coaching and some extra podcast stuff and just... interesting times. I think we'll be all right, but just depends on how long school shut for.
Yeah, and, it'll get worse before it gets better.
Yeah,
there'll be more restrictions, and like I'm still surprised. Like Wednesday is my only locked in day for teaching at the moment, and I got the text message today saying, "Yeah, we need you tomorrow." So I'm still in there at this stage tomorrow. Whereas Viv's working from home now.
Yep.
But we're so lucky to be able to run.
That's a highlight of my day at the moment.
Look at every other sport. If you played just about every other sport, you wouldn't have your outlet. Like you wouldn't be able to go and train with your team. Whereas I can still jump in the car, drive my 10 minutes out to Mulligan's, do what I need to do. And I feel like, as I said before, like I have some normality and like the world is still relatively normal for me then. So we're pretty lucky.
Yeah, I'm enjoying that. And I'm looking forward to like maybe driving out to this forest that we've got about 20 minutes out of town and just getting lost in there and, looking for some new trails. And yeah, we'll see. Every week, I think at the moment when we're on here, things are going to be changing. So we'll see where we're at this time next week. All right, mate. Thanks for that.
Take care. See ya.
Same to you. Bye.
Personal bests are exciting, but only when they're earned. No one likes a course cutter, so why do we settle for GPS watches that can't provide an accurate measurement on the track? Introducing Coros Wearable's new track mode, a first-of-its-kind technology that provides an accurately calibrated measurement on your local 400-meter track, regardless of which lane you choose to run. Gone are the days of your watch splitting 50 to 100 meters early per kilometer. This innovative technology isn't the only thing to make Coros watches stand out. They also feature the absolute best battery life in the industry. With as high as 60 hours of true GPS battery life, you'll never have to worry about your watch giving up before you do. All of this backed by a 2-year limited warranty. Interested in learning more about the latest performance technologies in GPS watches? Follow Coros Australia at coros_au or check out www.coros.com.
All right, welcome to the Inside Running Podcast this week for the interview, Zach Bitter.
Hey, thanks for having me.
All the way over in Phoenix, Arizona. We're just talking off air about how it's a bit different, the old time zones. Morning for me, afternoon for you.
Yeah, it's always fun to schedule those type of podcasts on the podcast I co-host. We've had some folks from New Zealand and Australia on in the past, and it's always working one morning and one afternoon is how it ends up playing out usually.
Yeah, yeah. And obviously your own podcast, I was just looking this morning, you're up to 193 episodes. So does it often feel strange to go on somebody else's, or like a bit of a natural now, of course?
Yeah, that's actually funny because when I started getting more into podcasts like years ago, I would listen to a lot and I'd go on a lot. And my experience kind of began as the guest, I suppose. So I had been on quite a few podcasts before I ever co-hosted or hosted one of my own. So that was actually kind of the more of the kind of awkward learning curve, I guess, whereas being the guest has always felt a little more, maybe a little more natural.
Yeah, you'd have a great insight though. And even like the Joe Rogan stuff, like even my wife this morning was like, oh my God, you're interviewing a guy who's been on Joe Rogan twice. Like that was that kind of like the pinnacle, and then everything else just kind of seems pretty relaxed after that.
Yeah, yeah, that one definitely is by far the biggest podcast I've been on. And it is a little nerve-wracking at the beginning, I think, when you just realize like, yeah, there's going to be over a million plus people who see and listen to this, and that'll be probably the biggest reach out of anything I'll ever have. So, it comes with a little bit more nerves, I would say. But, you know, Joe's great at what he does, and that's probably why he's had the podcast go the way it has. So he makes you kind of feel like it's a conversation. You settle in, and then it's kind of just drowns out any of the big reach type of stuff until afterwards.
Yeah, you'd almost forget that's, you know, that amount of people are watching or, you know, downloading it, wouldn't you? And just that kind of that natural conversation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You kind of forget after a while. And now the first time I went on, it was a little different because he was still live streaming his show. So it's like, as soon as they hit record, you're like, okay, here we go. Whereas the second time I went on, he hasn't been doing that as much lately. So it's like a little different feeling. It's just weird, like knowing that people are live watching versus even if it's not going to get edited at all, like just knowing like it's not out there as you're saying it is just a different feeling, I guess.
Yeah, awesome. I'll give you give our audience a few stats about you. Obviously, you're the 100-mile world record holder. You run 100 miles in 11 hours, 19 minutes and 13 seconds. You're also the 12-hour world record holder. Where you ran 168.7 kilometers. Sorry about the kilometers miles thing. We might be a bit different down here in Australia. A lot of our listeners will only know K's. So hopefully I don't confuse you talking about K's too much today, but that was 104.88 miles. And I looked up some of your other personal bests. I hope these ones are right. I've got 5K at 15:28.
Yep.
10K at 32:07.
Yep.
2:31 marathon.
Yep.
3:03 50K-er.
Yep.
50 miles in 5:12, which is 3:53K pace for our listeners.
Yep, and sounds right.
And 100K at 6:39.09, which is just under 4-minute kilometer pace as well.
Yeah, yeah, that's the rundown.
That's the rundown. It's good to know your Strava is correct where you list your PRs there. So, but some of those PBs or PRs must be from back early days. Like, I can't imagine you've run a recent 5 or 10 kilometer race.
Yeah, it's been a long time. I was perhaps a little bit of a late bloomer in that when I got to college, I kind of looked to my left and looked to my right and realized that there was a lot of guys there who had been running quite a bit more than I had in high school. And I thought, like, okay, I've got a pretty big learning curve to kind of tackle. And I actually set my 5K and 10K PRs after college. And the 5K PR actually came on the back end of a two-a-day. So it was just kind of an interesting kind of way I guess I looked at running, where after college I did some shorter stuff for a little bit and didn't really have as much of a time like I would have expected from with the kind of team atmosphere in college, and started to kind of just turning more to the types of workouts that I enjoyed doing versus doing things just for the sake of trying to hit a PR. And that kind of led me into just doing like higher volume training. And that kind of more or less led me into kind of ultra marathons. And that's kind of where I've been putting a lot of my focus since the end of 2010.
Yeah, it's almost like the opposite to some of the people in the US system, though, where they do have those super fast and successful years in like high school and college, and then almost fall off the face of the earth and drop out and kind of enter the real world in a way.
Yeah, you know, it can take a lot out of you, I think. When I actually look at that as, you know, when my first year in college, when I was, you know, looking around, like I said earlier, is at the time I felt like I was kind of at a disadvantage, whereas now I appreciate kind of the slow transition into the sport. So I'm very much a high mileage runner now, and I think some people will look at the training I do and feel like it's potentially unsustainable or, you know, too much. But if you look at kind of the way I kind of eased into it, I think that's where the recipe for success with a high volume approach is kind of just inching up year after year after year, and then finally kind of normalizing what would be kind of higher mileage for a lot of folks, so that you have that tool in your toolbox, so to speak, and you're able to kind of lean on that if that's what works for you. So for me, it was kind of, you know, in high school, I'd run not even year round, just during the season, most of my high school cross country and track. And by my senior year, I think I started running year round, but I was never really running more than say 30 miles a week. And then when I got into college, you know, the incoming freshmen were usually doing 50 to 60 miles a week. So I had to kind of put fast forward on a little bit and get up into that ballpark or close to. And then every year after that in college was basically just like adding about 10 miles per week to your average throughout the course of your kind of collegiate career. So when I finished college, I was kind of right at that precipice of slightly normalizing that kind of 80 to 90 mile training week, which I guess what would that be for kilometers? We can probably figure that out.
It's just under about 160. 100 miles is usually 100, or is 160. So yeah, probably
160,
just
yeah,
a bit under.
Sure. So then, you know, then it was just kind of adding a little more to that when I started focusing on a little more volume and a little less intensity. Like what I was saying before, I was just kind of gravitating a little more to what I enjoyed versus what I guess more or less would be ideal for any specific 5K, 10K marathon type training plan. And, you know, that kind of put the foundation in place, I think, to where when I go through some of these more brutal high mileage, like ultra marathon training sessions or big peak weeks and things like that, it just seems to be a little easier to reach, or it's not as much of an overreach as what it may have been, or maybe to someone who doesn't have that background in kind of slowly increasing their volume over time.
Yeah, and like going back to the start for you in like high school, what like drew you to running in the first place?
Yeah, it's you know, I was probably like your average middle school like kid where I found that I was better at the mile than I was at the 100 meter dash. And, you know, in 6th, 7th, and 8th grade, if I could win the mile or get like second to last in the 100, I was going to pick the mile every time. And that was kind of like my first exposure to distance running at all. And then when I got into high school, kind of a similar scenario of just like, you know, not very good at football, not very good at basketball, but, you know, by my sophomore year, I could, you know, be on varsity for cross country and track. So it just made a lot of sense in terms of where I thought my abilities were. And then from there, it kind of just led into kind of learning more about the sport versus just, hey, going out there because I think I can win a race or I can, you know, do well. It turned into like, well, what produces a good race? What kind of training do you need to do? What is all like the training methodology and all that stuff, and kind of getting into some of the more the details of the sport and kind of figuring out exactly what you need to do to show up on race day and have your best potential performance.
So you were a real student of the sport, like you're reading up on all kind of different training philosophies and figuring out what's going to work best for you, kind of trial and error a bit in a way as well?
Yeah. You know, it's always interesting to kind of see what types of plans and protocols have produced success over the years in some of the more traditional distances. And I would say ultra marathoning is still a little bit in development in terms of knowing, like, what is the best strategy. I think there's a lot of good area or good information out there, and it's certainly accelerating, but it's also just a little more kind of gray in the sense that it's really hard to pull a lot of information out of studies and things like that that would tell you, like, well, what's going to be best at mile 80 of a 100 miler, unlike, you know, some of these shorter distance things where we can kind of recreate the environment in a lab and kind of see what works best and what doesn't. And it gets really kind of fun and interesting to kind of play with those variables and see how they work for you versus someone else. And, you know, are you like similar to others, or do you have any individual things that are different that seem to work for you but not for others? And it's just kind of a cool game to play, more or less.
Yeah. And any like standout influences in that kind of university kind of stage when you were kind of developing your own learnings?
In terms of just like people who were like coaches and stuff like that?
Yeah, or like like a Lydiard kind of training philosophy or anything like that?
Yeah, you know, Lydiard was one of the first kind of popular coaches I think I got into. I probably dove into some of his stuff a little bit after college, and during college I was more or less just listening to my coach who had been around for quite some time, Coach Rick Witt at UW-Stevens Point, and he had a lot of, like, my knowledge of the sport and the methodology training was so limited at that point that, you know, I probably could only tolerate one person's content in order to be able to absorb it all. So
yeah,
during college was more leaning on what his stuff. After college, jumping into stuff and looking at like kind of the Lydiard philosophies and reading a lot of different like kind of training protocols and just looking at kind of what the best mode for something like ultra marathon might be to translate over. Cause you know, the big difference when you get into ultra marathon stuff is just, it becomes a lot harder to replicate race day. So when you think of like an elite marathoner, you know, they might go out and do their kind of keystone final long run or big long run workout of the buildup and do like 18-ish miles at their goal marathon pace. So they've kind of closed that gap down to where they can probably predict within minutes, as long as something crazy doesn't happen or something unsuspected doesn't happen, what about what time they're going to be able to hit on race day. And, you know, for something like 100 miles or even further, you know, going out for like, you know, anything close to 75% is basically going to have to be like another event. So you're leaning on some of your more finite experiences, I would say, from other events, from some workouts, and trying to extrapolate out a lot further. And that's where I think it gets kind of interesting with ultra marathon.
Yeah, we have a saying on the show, like when we're preparing for marathons, that you want to get close to the fire without getting burnt. And we can kind of do that, as you said. But for you guys, it's a whole different world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's, you know, it's interesting because I think there's a lot that can be used from kind of the more traditional distances. And you know, I think especially the marathon, I think, is just one of those kind of incredible distances where it's just fast enough that it, you know, you can really, really hurt if you misplace your timing. And it's just long enough that if you do misplace it and are starting to hurt, you're gonna have to hurt for quite a while. So that one is, I think, an intriguing distance, even though I haven't really specialized in it in any way.
Yeah, and like you mentioned before that you really enjoyed the long run in your training. What about the long run like appeals to you the most?
Oh, that's a good question. I think it was it kind of happened a little like different than what maybe people would expect. I think just when I just thought about kind of what I enjoyed about my experience of cross country and track and field in college, if you had asked me which workout did I look forward to the most, it was always kind of the long run for whatever reason. So that kind of just gravitated towards it. And I don't know, maybe it was the sharp pain of the short intervals that made me less appealing to that. But the long run seemed to be something I just enjoyed and I could do for quite a while and stay happy doing it. So kind of testing that out a little bit was kind of an exciting time for me to just see where that led.
Yeah, and when you started to test it out and got into the ultra running, like, was that all individual? Like, you were going out for solo long runs and kind of getting the training done by yourself, or like, were you a part of a group or mates, or how was that working?
Yeah, I think when I did my first ultra marathon, I was doing a lot of running by myself. I would do, I think my longest long run before, my first ultra marathon was a 50 miler or 80K, and I think my longest long run was a 30 miler that I had done on my by myself. So I'd done a lot of solo, and I still do quite a bit of my training on my own, and it's just kind of the way I've kind of, I guess, adapted to the sport. But it makes, when you do join a group or hop in with some friends or something to go for a run, it makes those kind of a little more memorable, a little more motivating, I think, than if you're doing it every day, I guess. So I like both aspects of the sport, training with people, training by myself, but I end up probably training by myself a little more than anything. And some of that might just be kind of scheduling stuff with everyone else. They have schedules that they got to stick to, and your training time doesn't always match up with theirs.
Yeah, and mentally, though, that's got to help you prepare for the longer distance stuff when you are by yourself with, you know, often so many kilometers or miles to go.
Yeah, and, you know, it is interesting. Like, you even get in some of the more competitive ultra marathons, and sometimes you find yourself in no man's land where you're just, like, nothing but you and a trail or you and a road and, you know, an undetermined number of miles to go or something like that. So it's it is, I think there is probably something about training solo that kind of helps you, like, prepare you for some of the hard mental spots in an ultra marathon. But, you know, it's also good to have the company from time to time.
Yeah. And when did, like, the success start to come, like, sponsors kind of get on board and you kind of start experiencing some wins? And, like, when did this become more than just going out for some long runs and experimenting with training?
Yeah, so the end of 2011, I guess, is when I started to kind of put together what I would consider a complete, like, ultra marathon season. I did 350 milers or 80 kilometer races kind of that fall, early winter time frame. And then 2012 was the first full year where I kind of did a kind of late winter, early spring season, and then also did kind of a late summer, fallish type early winter season as well. And most ultra marathoning is done kind of in two kind of seasons, I guess. You'd have the first half of the year and the second half of the year, and a lot of people are not racing as much usually in the middle of the year during the summer months, but yeah, there's still stuff available if you want it. But most people break it up like that just because it's a little more sustainable, I think, and you can have like a real off season then. But I had 2012 was my first kind of full season of racing ultras, and I had some good races there, but probably nothing that was like kind of popping up on people's radar in the to the degree where it would make me like really appealing to any sponsors. But in 2013, I had a race at the Desert Solstice Track Invitational here in Phoenix, Arizona, where I had broke the American record at the time and then the world record for 12 hours. And that was probably the race that gave me the most attention to date at that time anyway. And then people were kind of a little more interested into what I was up to. Sponsors wanted to kind of give their support. And I was really lucky that a lot of the products I had already been using were some of the sponsors that were interested. So kind of starting to connect those relationships and create that sort of stuff in the end of 2013, early 2014 is when things kind of started to pick up for me a bit. And 2015, I rebroke the American record in an effort to try to break the world record at the same race at Desert Solstice. So that one was another race that kind of got a fair bit of media attention and more or less led to my first round on the Joe Rogan Experience. And then after that, I just kind of was chasing the world record off and on throughout the next four-ish years until the end of last year where I broke the world record for both 100 miles and 12 hours. And there was a lot of stuff in between there, too. I did world 100Ks three times. I had won the San Diego 100 mile, the Javelina 100 mile, and a lot of other races in there getting to that. But those were kind of some of the big ones that more or less were ones that kind of drew some attention.
Yeah, and you would have noticed like the growth in the sport over the years you've been involved in it as well. Like it's really taken off, the ultra running, and it kind of seems like, you know, the longer you've progressed in it, the sport has grown alongside you.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's just incredible how competitive the sport has gotten and the interest. I think when I first got into it in 2010, we were starting to see a little more of a kind of like the collegiate athletes start to take interest in it, because before then, it was kind of like ultra marathon is something you kind of ended up in after you kind of exhausted yourself with some of the more traditional distances. And then it started to, I think in North America anyway, it started to get popular on the trails, and that was partly due to some big like media outreach stuff. Dean Karnazes he wrote a book and did a lot of like publicity stuff that kind of brought attention to the average person of what an ultramarathon was. There was a book called Born to Run that got a lot of attention, that kind of also introduced the sport to the kind of the average person. And then you started seeing a lot more folks say like, hey, I'm done with my collegiate running career. I'm kind of sick of the road. I'm kind of sick of the trail, or I'm sorry, sick of the track. But these trail runs in the mountains are amazing. So the trail scene in the U.S. really started to pick up then. And not just from the competitive side, but just even, you know, like every portion of the field started to kind of increase in numbers. And we've just been seeing kind of exponential growth since then. So, you know, with that, you see a lot of records fall. You see a lot of course records get kind of redefined. And essentially, the sport gets redefined in, over the course of a decade when you have that much growth. And it's been pretty cool to be a part of that.
Yeah, and the likes of like yourself and Killian and Jim Walmsley, we just saw him kind of drop down to the marathon for the U.S. trials. Like, obviously, really kind of big superstar figures in the sport now as well.
Yeah, I think Killian and Jim are definitely kind of on the male side, the top dudes in the world in terms of just what they've been able to do and kind of their influence on the sport. So it's fun to see those guys try different things, like Jim kind of coming off the trails a little bit and taking his a swing at the Olympic trials. And then also I think he's going to parlay that into an attempt at Comrades, which I – looking at his training, I think is maybe where his efforts are really kind of skewed towards. But that'll be exciting to see what he can do over there in South Africa at Comrades. Because the interesting thing in North America is everyone knows in the ultra running community of Comrades, but it's not really on people's radar the way it is from a standpoint that it is in South Africa, and just the magnitude of that event where they have, I believe they just increased their field size, but there's somewhere around 25,000 runners now. And like over 1 million people tune in to watch that in South Africa. There's aid stations every 2 kilometers, and the aid stations are like absolutely packed. Like you can have a crew of multiple people at an aid station and not see them because they get drowned out in the crowd and you just pass by and they miss you. It's pretty cool. It's more like a big city marathon in terms of the way it kind of feels when you're at a race like that. So with that kind of interest, you get some pretty fast folks kind of targeting that one. And I think we see some of the best performances in ultra marathon at that race every year.
Yeah, and you've been there as well, 32nd. You did it in a down year, is that right?
Yeah, I believe I did it in 2016, and it was an awesome experience, and I need to get back to Comrades and give that one another shake. I think it would be fun to kind of target a top 10 at that event, as that's been something that's been tougher for North American males to do consistently over history.
Yeah, and it seems like they think about Comrades over in South Africa as if we kind of just think about the marathon. Like it's a bit of the, you know, if you haven't done a marathon or you haven't done Comrades, you kind of haven't done anything in the running world yet, which is pretty incredible to think about being so far distance.
Yeah, it's kind of here in the US we kind of compare it to the Boston Marathon, because it's like, you know, someone will ask, oh, you're a marathon runner or you're a runner, have you done Boston? And if you say yes, they automatically think you're one of the best runners in the country. If you say no, you could be a 13:55 5K guy, and if you didn't do Boston, the average person wouldn't think you were good. So it's kind of funny.
So can we?
But yeah, they definitely love it over there.
Do you think you'll go back? Like, is it on the bucket list to get back there?
Yeah, I'll get there at some point. I think it'll be. It'll probably won't be this year or next year, but I'm going to take another swing at it at some point. And I'm 34 now, so like, ideally I'll do it maybe a couple more times before I'm 40 and just give it a couple good shots. And even if it's just a like kind of building up towards something longer, it'd be fun to get out there and give it another go.
Yeah, for sure. Hey, let's talk about your world records. I'm not sure if I mentioned in the introduction, but that 100 mile and 12 hour, they're both on the track. So it's a long time going around in circles. You must be super proud because it took you a couple of times to nail it. But kind of, I guess, summarize for our audience what it's like to be a world record holder and then what has to go into that preparation to make that happen on the day.
Yeah, no, that's a good question. I mean, it's cool. I would be lying if I said it's not cool to be a world record holder. I think that's was one of my goals, was to break that record. What I like about it the most personally, though, is just kind of the journey leading to it, because it just taught me so much about myself and so much about, you know, the patience of a sport like this, which you can kind of translate into everyday life, and just kind of learning from mistakes versus looking at them as failures was really big for me. And it's funny because when I broke the American record for 100 miles in 2013, my next kind of goal was to break the world record. I ran 11:47 that year for 100. So I was like 18-ish minutes off of the world record at the time. And I thought, okay, well, I can probably chisel away at that and maybe I'll break it in 2014. And I laugh at that now, as it took me another almost 6 years to finally get to that spot where I connected enough to get under that previous world record of 11:28. So it was a lot of kind of trial and error, in the sense that, you know, there's always kind of a balance of like, well, how do I structure my entire training plan versus like the key six-ish, eight-ish weeks leading into the race itself, and also trying to tease out kind of how much of this is just learning from prior experiences on race day and then making decisions differently because now you know something that you didn't know there. Learning like when your mind is trying to get you to kind of slow down when you physically actually don't need to, I think is something I learned a lot in that 6 years between 2013 and 2019. And I think one thing that I did differently too that I wouldn't have guessed at the time, but I think ended up helping out quite a bit, was I moved to Phoenix about a little over 2 years ago. And when I did that, I just had a lot more access to a variety of different running. We've got tons of great trails out here in Phoenix. We've got good weather most of the year. We also have access to a lot of flat runnable stuff. So, you know, I could basically train for almost any event without having to travel too far. And what I ended up kind of deciding to do when I moved here was I'm going to train for stuff on the trails, a little more climbing and descending for half the year. And then I'm going to train for some flatter, faster stuff the second half of the year. And that really kind of gave me an opportunity to maybe step back from some of the flat, fast stuff that I had been focusing on a little more holistically between, you know, the years of 2013 to 2016-17. And really just kind of like step away from it and focus on something else, like watch other variables in training develop versus, you know, a certain pace per mile for 100 miles on a 400-meter track. And I think when I got back around to doing it at the end of 2019, after spending the first half of that year training for the San Diego 100, was that I was really, really excited to kind of like do the work required to end up running the race I did. And then by the time I got to the race day, I had done probably just enough to like feel like I had the fitness I needed, but also I had enough of a break from it where I was excited to be there and I really wanted to kind of push when my body normally would want to kind of break down. So on the race day itself, it was, I would say like when I started that event, I didn't feel like especially great. I didn't feel like I had, you know, a ton of spring in my legs. And, you know, when I kind of reflect on that, I feel like that could be a good thing, in the sense that when you're out there for 100 miles, if you have too much pop in your legs, then you might end up using that, and it's probably not going to work to your favor if you're trying to pace yourself realistically. So I was maybe a little more conservative than I had originally planned through like the first 40 miles or so. And when I kind of looked at my pace through 40 miles and started kind of running the numbers through my head to find out where I would probably split halfway, 50 miles or 8K, and then where I would split at 62.5 or 100K, you know, I was a little nervous that I didn't quite have it And historically, I'd never negative split 100 mile before. So even the thought of trying to even split a race felt a little daunting to me. And coming through 80K or 50 miles in 5:40, I knew if I doubled that, I would just, you know, be a handful of minutes underneath the world record. And that's where I think the first seed of doubt started creeping in my mind, where I thought to myself, maybe this isn't my day. Maybe I should just settle in and take what I get and, you know, rally for a different race down the road. And that, luckily I didn't let that kind of develop too long, because that's kind of what happens in these events, especially these really short track events where you have such immediate access to information, is if things start spiraling in a bad way, they can spiral really fast and you find yourself maybe like pulling the plug a little earlier than you needed to, but they can also spiral in the positive direction too for that. So
sorry to interrupt though. What did you do to not let it spiral, like when you're in that kind of situation?
Yeah, so I mean, what I did is I kind of thought to myself, just like, okay, well, what are the downsides if I just kind of let go of this one and relax it a bit? And you know, my first thought was, well, you know, I put in like some pretty big training leading into this. I've got this opportunity at the Pettit Center, which is an indoor track that's built around a speed skating rink, so they keep it at like 60 degrees, so there's no sun, no wind, climate control. You know, I was just telling myself, I'm 40 miles into this race that I've spent, you know, a couple months building up for, and I'm on pace for what I need to do. Is this really something I want to throw away right away and kind of have to start all over again? So I started kind of thinking about that, and that led me to kind of just saying, convincing myself essentially, just, okay, let's just do a few more laps or a few more miles at goal pace and just kind of see where it goes from there. And then you kind of turn the ship, so to speak, and start spiraling kind of the other way, because then I got my splits down into the range I was looking for. And for the listeners too, like, to give you a little bit of context of kind of how I structure a race on a track like that, is I pick a pace that I'm trying to aim for, or a time I'm trying to aim for, and then I calculate kind of what range of splits will I want per quarter mile or per 400 meter. Or with this track was a little different, because it was actually like 430, I think 34 meters per loop. So it was a little more skewed, but I had like a range between like 2 or 3 seconds of where I was trying to hit that would put me at where I thought my high end potential was versus the world record. And, you know, I got myself back into that range and realized, you know, this doesn't really feel all that much worse than it did when I was out of the range for those last couple miles. And that started to build momentum. And then when I hit 50 miles at 5:40, I wouldn't say I was through the doubt quite yet at that point, but I had a really good stretch between 80K and 100K. And I ended up coming through 100K about I think it was 4 minutes faster than I had predicted I would at mile 40. So that was a kind of a huge mental lift, where I knew I was heading in the right direction versus the wrong direction. And from 100K, the next kind of benchmark I had in my mind was trying to get within my longest long run for that buildup. And I had done a handful of long runs that were between like 27 and 32 miles, or like roughly 50K in training. So I knew if I could get within around 50K to go, I would be able to just convince myself that just one more long run versus I'm out here trying to run 100 miles at, you know, whatever pace. So when I got to that point, I kind of just assessed how I felt, and I didn't feel nearly as run down as I had historically at that point in the race. So I started kind of just convincing myself that, okay, I can do this. I can do one more long run and, you know, break the world record. And that just kind of continued until I got to about 80 miles was also another kind of key point for me. Because in 2015, when I broke the American record for 100 miles, I was on world record pace through 80 miles. So when I hit 80 miles in 2015, I needed to average 7 flat to break the world record. And the world record pace was 6:53 at the time. So I didn't even have to run the pace of the average for the world record at that point to break it. But I couldn't. I fell apart and ended up averaging like 7:30s or somewhere around there for the last 20 miles and let the world record kind of slip away. So when I hit 80 at the Pettit Center in August last year, it was part of me was just like, okay, I waited 4 years almost to kind of get back to this spot, and now I have the opportunity to really kind of close it out versus let it kind of slide out. And I ran some of my strongest miles from 80 to the finish. So that was kind of maybe the highlight of the event for me.
Thanks for that insight. Like, it's just so interesting to hear about what goes through your mind. And I'm sure there's a lot of listeners out there as well. When there's 5K to go, we have, like, I'm not sure if you're familiar with parkrun, like parkrun over here, and we often say, like, it's just one more parkrun to go. So it's not, you know, 30 or 40K like you do, but we kind of break things down as well. When you're talking about your splits, are you looking at your watch, or is there a big board every lap? And, like, do you ever just ignore that for a few laps and just kind of let your mind wander a bit?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because I think a lot of times when people jump into some of these timed events, these short loop courses, they're doing it because they can control so much and they have that access to information that they maybe wouldn't in like a trail event or a less structured event like that. And they do have most events do have, like, they'll put like a big TV up and they'll have the timing mat. So every time you hit the timing mat, they'll usually put the TV, say, like 20 meters past. So once you hit the timing mat, your name pops up on the top of the screen. You can see your distance, your average pace, your lap pace, and all that stuff. So the way I kind of do it is, like I said earlier, I have these like ranges of kind of splits I'm trying to stay between. And I'll do like the first few laps, I'll watch that and kind of just make sure I'm in there. And I'll just kind of calibrate like what that intensity feels like. And once I kind of have that dialed in, I'll just kind of stop watching that board for a while and just kind of stay in that kind of intensity. And I'll spot check it every once in a while just to make sure that, you know, my perceived effort hasn't changed and I'm not slipping in and out of that range. But I'm usually just checking it. If I'm in, I keep going. If I'm not, I recalibrate and just kind of keep doing that. And one of the reasons I don't watch it every lap is because, you know, you can just burn so much mental energy if you're counting down from, you know, a traditional track is 402 and a half laps. This one was 363. But, you know, if you're saying like, okay, 362 laps to go, 361 laps to go, that sort of mentality is going to, you're going to get to like 80 miles and not have any mental energy left to push when your body's telling you to stop. So I tried to be a little cautious of trying to absorb too much or overthink too much. And there's also a phase of just kind of dealing with the monotony of an environment like that. I mean, it's about as fast of an environment as you can get, but it's also as a monotonous of an environment, you do one loop and you've seen the entire course. So they're like daydreaming or getting in kind of a bit of a flow type of state is actually one of the best things you can do, because you can get yourself in a bit of a time warp if you're having a good day and you're hitting your splits consistently and just you know, more or less daydream or picture yourself somewhere other than the track you're on. And that can kind of save some of that mental energy as well for the end when you have to really feel like you're pushing the pedal down.
Yeah. And I suppose having a 400 or just over 400 meter track as well would be good for your crew to kind of give you nutrition and hydration. And like, do they just put a portaloo like in one of the lanes as well? Like, it's easy to get yourself sorted.
Yeah. It's kind of funny. They'll usually have at least a few lanes reserved for running. And then just outside of the last lane, they'll let people set up tables for crew. And then they'll put a porta potty out there, usually a couple of them. And then, so if you need to stop to use the bathroom, you just pull over and hop in real quick and then hop out real quick. And when it comes to nutrition and hydration, you have someone just handing you whatever you want. So what I did before this last one was I kind of had a game plan as to like what I was going to want and when I was going to want it. And then I just let my crew know, if I deviate from this, I'll let you know. Otherwise, plan on me grabbing this every 30 minutes and that every 60 minutes and this at this interval. So they kind of had a bit of a scaffolding of what I was likely going to do. And, you know, the nice thing about that is you can change your game plan so easily, because if I decide I want to do something different, I tell them, and then 400-ish meters later, you know, they've already made the change for the most part. So you never really have to venture too far from making a correction, whereas in a lot of the trail races, you go into an aid station and then head out, you made a mistake, you might pay for that for the next, like, you know, 5, 6, 7+ miles before you get to the next aid station, and by then you may have kind of tanked a good portion of your race. So that is the nice part, is the logistical side of things.
And what about, you'd be other people on the track, so you'd end up covering way more than 100 miles, wouldn't you, like going into lane 2 and going around people?
Yeah, that's the one variable I haven't controlled so far, is a lot of these events are done in the context of like a 24-hour or a 48-hour event. So as you can imagine, anyone running 24 or 48 hours is going to be pacing themselves a lot more conservatively than someone like myself who's trying to target 12 hours or 100 miles. So, you know, every event's a little different. Some of them spread out differently. Some of them have smaller field sizes. Some of them have folks that are, you know, targeting shorter, faster races, and you spend a little more time in lane one than others. This one at the Pettit Center, I probably averaged lane two if I had to, like, look at, you know, the amount of time I spent in lane one and lane three, and then the bulk of it was basically in lane two. So you kind of give back a little bit with that. But you're also gaining quite a bit, especially at the Pettit Center, where you can complete climate control and all that stuff. Yeah, so, yeah. But there is getting a little more interest in some of these kind of flat record chasing type events here in the U.S. and elsewhere. So we'll start seeing some events pop up in the next year or two where, you know, they're more structured to 100 miles and below. And I think we can shave off a few minutes with just sticking to lane one the whole way.
Yeah, well, this was like, I read a book on it not so long ago. It was called Running for Their Lives. And it was, this used to be a thing. Like, people would go around the track for 12 or 24 hours and massive crowds and betting. And, like, yeah, it was a massive spectacle.
Yeah, it's funny when people think of ultra marathon, especially I think here in the States, they think, like, oh, this is a relatively new sport. Or a lot of times they'll look at the Western States 100 and think, okay, well, that's the first 100 miler. And it's, you know, Western States is a great event and a very historic event, but it's nowhere near the first ultra marathon they were doing. They were packing Madison Square Garden in New York in the 1800s. So, yeah, and it was a spectacle. And I was talking to someone about that not too long ago. We were trying to figure out, like, well, why was it so popular back then? And we came to the conclusion that there was two things at play. They let them bet on the runners. Yeah. So there was a lot of interest with that. And there's no Netflix, there's no TV, there's no, like, you know, there's all these weird, like, draws that kind of, like, take away from what would entertain you over 100 years ago. So, you know, I guess when you don't have some of those in-home convenience entertainment things, you go out to Madison Square Garden and watch a bunch of crazy people run around the track a bunch of times.
Yeah, and I think the unknown factor as well about, you know, is someone going to pass out here or not make it, like it must have been. Right. And that tension would obviously just build as the races go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it's funny because, like, you'll see this, I think, in the sport in general too, where especially as the distances get longer, where you can have someone hit a split in a race that's just mind-blowing, and you think, you get yourself starting to, like, plan forward, like, well, if they keep this pace, they're going to run this time, and it's going to blow the course record out of the water. And then you start to think, like, well, you know, someone who is maybe capable of running an hour slower than the course record can probably come through mile 40 on course record pace or faster than course record. That doesn't mean they should, though. So we see a lot of that carnage, I think, in some of these more competitive ones too, where, you know, people get kind of hung up in the atmosphere, or for whatever reason think they're going to have the race of their life, and then it ends up being more of an average race. And yeah, you can see that. I think that makes it kind of exciting too, though, because you're just waiting to who makes it. You get a big enough field, especially on the competitive end, and you know, someone's gonna hold on and will have that race of their life. So then it becomes this guessing game of who will that be.
Yeah, and with, like, the growth of the sport and more kind of commercial sponsors, and I'm not sure if I'm assuming the prize money has gone up and up over the years as well. Do you see many, like, East Africans, like we see on the roads in the marathon and 5 and 10K and things like that? Are they starting to come up to the ultra distances as well?
Not a lot, not in North America anyway. You're seeing a little more of it, I think, over in, like, Morocco, where there's a pretty, like, big ultra running kind of build up over there. I mean, we're seeing a lot of the South Africans getting interested in Comrades. The interesting thing is Comrades has drawn some of the East Africans down there in the past. And, I mean, cause it's, if you win Comrades and you're wearing, you know, Nike shoes, you're going to make get a pretty good payday from that race. And then you're going to get, if you win Comrades, you're going to get a sponsorship, probably a handful of them. So, like, it can make a career. So, like, you would think that more East Africans, especially ones that are, like, kind of that in that range where they're not quite fast enough to say, like, you know, head over to the Chicago Marathon and win it or qualify for the Olympic team, would take a crack at it more often. And I'd have to look at some stats to see how often that happens. But I know one of my buddies here in the U.S. who is more in tune with all the ins and outs of Comrades, Jeff Burns, he was saying that there has been like that attempt been made, and it just doesn't seem to quite translate as cleanly as someone would like. I think a good marathoner can make a good Comrades runner, no doubt. But I think once you get up into the 100-mile distance, I think it gets even more kind of interesting, because what makes you really good at 100 miles may be what kind of holds you back from being a great marathoner, and what makes you like a world-class marathoner may come at the cost of being a great 100-miler. So, I mean, it's if I had to guess, if every like sub 210 marathoner decided to run ultra marathons, I think we would see records get blown out of the water, because even if it is a completely different discipline, you got to imagine some of them have the ultra running gene, so to speak, as well, and would just have like the best of both worlds and really crush it. But I think it takes a few rounds, especially when you get on some of the longer stuff, and especially when you get on things like, you know, trails. If it's got any technicality, it becomes a little bit of a skill set to develop. So it's not quite as clean as if I'm fast, I'll be great. But, you know, we kind of see that in other distances too. You know, you don't always have like, you know, great 5K runners translate into the marathon either. So there'll always probably be a little bit of that.
Yeah, even the half to the marathon, like two different worlds there as well. And what about, you're probably the perfect guy to ask this question too, with the nutrition. And, you know, you're well documented being kind of a high fat and animal products for training. And then you go to carbs on race day. Have I got that right?
Yeah, that's the simplest way to describe it is I try to go as low as I can during training on carbs without sacrificing my results in terms of hitting the workout paces I'm trying to hit. And on race day, I try to eat as many carbs as I can get in without having a stomach issue. So, excuse me. Okay. I tried to mute it before I coughed into the microphone. Yeah. But so on race day, it gets a little tricky, and you have to kind of play around with it in training to figure out if it's going to work for you or not. But generally speaking, if you want to try to take in like the maximum amount of fuel or the maximum amount of carbohydrate as what you've seen kind of in studies, you pretty much have to be practicing that on a fairly regular basis. I think it's Kipchoge actually is known for taking his race day fueling with him on basically every run. So he's very much adapting his body to be able to tolerate what he's going to try to digest on race day. So I think if you decide you're going to try to hit the upper limits of what you can digest during an ultra marathon, you probably need to be practicing it a lot and kind of go a more high carb route. Or you can kind of go a different route, which is the route I go, is kind of minimize the carbohydrate so that on race day you can minimize the logistics of having to try to get in that much fuel, and lean a little more heavily on fat metabolism. And I think the devil's in the details a lot with this stuff, and that's where it oftentimes goes off the rails when people are curious about it, is like, you know, they think like, oh, if it worked for Zach in the 100 miles, that means it must work for, you know, some elite 5K runner or some Olympic 10K athlete. And it's like, it's not quite as clean as that. So it is a little bit of a, I think at the individual level is where it starts to kind of become a potential application where, you know, most people in the sport of ultra marathoning, and certainly most people in the more traditional distances, are still following kind of a high carbohydrate diet. But, you know, some folks find that doesn't seem to work well for them, and then they can kind of come and explore maybe what I'm doing and see if there's better luck for them for whatever reason in that world. But there's a guy actually not too far from you in New Zealand, Professor Dan Plews, who is one of the leading researchers right now looking at kind of a more of a periodized carbohydrate process for endurance sport. And I think he's learning a lot about kind of the way to do it, and if it's got application at certain distances and things like that. And you know, he's been doing a lot of interesting things with like continuous glucose monitors and you know, timing the carbohydrates at the right point versus just going all in no carb or super low carb keto style versus, you know, kind of a super high carbohydrate diet. So it is interesting.
And it's going to be the future a bit too. Like, you know, I think I've heard you speak about Tim Noakes a couple of times and heard Tim Noakes on a number of different podcasts. And it just feels like it's more for, well, not more for, but just as much for health as it is performance. Like some of the foods we have when we're prepping for marathons or trying to get those high carb foods in are not great for health, but fantastic for performance in a way.
Yeah, I think there's probably some stuff to tease out of that. It's like, you know, when we look at kind of the health markers of like elite athletes, they don't tend to be great in some circumstances. So, you know, the question can be said, is that, you know, is it worth becoming, you know, going all in, so to speak, or putting every ounce of your energy into training for a race and trying to, like, you know, hit that engineered fuel as often as possible? Like, what are the unforeseen consequences or the repercussions down the road for something like that? And we probably have a lot to learn about that yet. And it could be very individual as well. But I think that's what guys like Dan Plews are kind of interested in right now, is like, where is the kind of perfect middle here where we can have enough on board so we can still find our max potential, but not necessarily jeopardize our long-term life or long-term health and longevity. So it'll be interesting to see kind of where that plays out and if there's certain events or distances that it's more applicable for than others. And I think the other interesting piece of that puzzle too is, like, you know, I think about this as a coach, is like, you know, when I'm coaching someone, it's pretty rare that I have a client come to me and say, you know, this is my life to try to run this race as fast as I can. I want to, like, you know, get every last ounce out of myself the next 5 to 10 years. And, you know, I don't care if it comes at the cost of my physical well-being. You know, most of them are coming to me like, well, I've got a family. I've got a job. I like to run. I'm interested in doing this 100-miler in 6 months. I realize that I'm not going to be able to train like a professional athlete, but I want to do my best with my situation, and then we'd go from there. So when you start looking at it from that lens, I think it's just, there's a lot more kind of tools that can be used from the nutritional side versus, you know, kind of looking at what we've seen in the labs with elite Olympic distance, you know, endurance athletes and things like that.
Yeah, which often the studies are based off, and then everyone tries to just copy it. It's an interesting one. Yeah. Hey, and I really love the way you deliver it, because you don't really try to throw it down people's throats. Like, it's kind of like, this is what I'm doing. You can do the reading yourself. I'm not trying to convince everyone in the world that you need to eat the same foods I do.
Yeah, you know, I think it's it gets interesting, because, I mean, you definitely see the polarization of kind of, especially on like social media, of like keto versus high carb and, you know, the back and forth there. And, you know, it's one of those things where I think, like, you know, if you're someone who adopted a keto diet and had like life-changing experience, it's like, I can understand that you're going to want to scream it from the rooftops if it was that big of a difference for you. And same with any like nutritional intervention. If you spent like a big portion of your life struggling with that, and then all of a sudden you found something that works really well, you want to tell everyone about it. But, you know, for me personally, like, I got into it from the individual side of things. And, you know, that's where I prefer to work with people, is at the individual level versus, you know, just trying to like educate the masses, so to speak, in terms of like, this is the number one way to go. You know, I'm more along the lines of let's get a list of different like approaches that could be potentially advantageous for you, and then let you pick which one looks the most appealing to you for your lifestyle and your interests and things like that, and start there. And we can always switch and change if we need to. I think when people are given choices, that's when they start to kind of really find what works for them versus just being told this is the only way to do it.
For sure. Zach, a few last questions before I let you go. What's coming up race-wise, and has the coronavirus, like the widespread all over the world, has that affected your race plans coming up?
Yeah, I know it's been just kind of in the last few days, actually, but as we kind of learn more and more, it has affected my race schedule a bit. I was signed up to do the Centurion 100 in London on April 18th. And that was going to be kind of a track 100 miler that also had some shorter distance stuff. So kind of like what I was saying earlier, a little bit more of an opportunity to probably hang out in lane one for most of the day. And that was going to kind of be my build up peak race for the first half of the year. And just in probably the last 24 to 48 hours, things started to kind of spiral in a way that made it look less and less likely that travel over to Europe is even going to be possible. And, you know, part of that trip was also centered around my wife, who's a, an ultra runner as well, was going to do the Madeira Island Ultra in Portugal, and that race actually just got canceled today, so that kind of threw a wrench into our travel plans in general. So I'm kind of circling the wagon, so to speak, and luckily there's also a flat or a track 100 miler here in the States that's just a few days earlier than what I was going to do on April 18th that I'll probably end up hopping into to minimize the travel a bit and try to focus the energies for this training block into that event versus the one in London. And I'll have to try to get to the London one down the road because the guys at Centurion Running are great and they're big fans of the sport, supporters of the sport, and they put on great events. So it'd be fun to go over there and do some of their stuff down the road.
And going by your Strava account, I saw the other day there was 40K on the track, and then you went back the next day and ran another, 48K and then 40K, kind of back-to-back. Is that world record? That's what you're going to have a crack at?
Yeah, what I'm trying to do is, like, if you look at my training kind of holistically, is I start to kind of get more specific to race intensity the closer I get to the race. So what that ends up being is, for like this track 100 milers, I pick a pace that I'm going to try to hit or a time I'm going to try to hit. And then when I get like 6 to 8 weeks inside of the race itself, I start trying to build volume at that intensity. And basically I'll do like build up weeks and then a deload week and then build up weeks where I'm trying to add more volume at that race intensity. So with an 1900 mile and the next goal for me, I guess, with that specific type of event is to see how close I can get to getting under 11 hours. So I've been kind of skewing a lot of that race day specific work towards kind of I guess it would be like a 6:30 to 6:35 minute mile, or right around a 4 minute and 2 second kilometer, I think, if I'm running the numbers right in my head, is kind of what I'm building up towards. So the last two weekends I did a Saturday Sunday combo, where the first weekend I did 25 and 25 miles, or 40K and 40K. And then this last weekend I did a little more with 30 miles and 25 miles. So I added five more, all right at that kind of that 6:30-ish to 4:02 kilometer pace. And with that, I'm also, I think I, if I remember the numbers right, I think I was just over 100 miles total that on both of those weeks at around that kind of goal 100 mile pace. So this week was a bit of a catch your breath, rest up, deload week, and then the next 2 weeks I'll do two probably bigger builds than the last two and just try to close that gap even closer to building volume towards that kind of specific stuff, and hopefully feel like that pace is comfortable enough to take a crack at it.
Yeah, good luck. It's going to be interesting watching from afar to see how that all kind of unfolds. And like sponsors in your corner that make this all possible?
Yeah, the big one that's been with me for quite a while is Ultra Footwear. They make a shoe that kind of is an ergonomic fit, so it fits your toe box. It's just like a foot-shaped toe box, balance cushion. They've got a concept called Fit for Her that is designed around women-specific last of the shoe, which is the mold you build a shoe around. So I'll be running in their stuff this year. And then, I've been really grateful to have them on board for the last few years and helped me kind of get from one race to the next, and hopefully many more to come.
Yeah, awesome. And the listeners can keep track and hear what's going on the Human Performance Outliers podcast, and you're following on Strava or anywhere else they need to tune into, Instagram?
Yeah, my website is zachbitter.com. He's got links to all that stuff. The Human Performance Outlier podcast, Instagram is at zachbitter, Twitter is at zbitter, and that's probably where I'm the most active. So, if anyone has any questions or wants me to dive into any of this any deeper, shoot me a note on one of those platforms, and I'll try to get back to you as quick as possible.
Awesome, mate. Thanks so much for your time today and, sharing some of your journey and insights for the Inside Running podcast listeners.
Awesome. Yeah, thank you so much for having me on.
Do you ever feel like your favorite running gear brand never listens to your needs? Koros Wearables prides itself on taking direct user feedback and turning it into constantly evolving, innovative software solutions. Your Koros watch will only get better with time.